The thrill and excitement of March Mania is here, and DraftKings Sportsbook, one of America's top-rated sportsbook apps, is giving new customers a shot to turn $5 into $150 instantly in bonus bets with any college basketball bet. You can find all the lines and available odds, of course, at the DraftKings Sportsbook app. North Carolina listeners, don't forget, DraftKings Sportsbook is now live in your state. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code SBNFL. New customers can bet $5 to get $150 instantly in bonus bets only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code SBNFL. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction, void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/bball for eligibility, deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Michael Kist.
You caught me not listening again.
Benjamin Solak.
You never listen!
It's the Kist and Solak Show. Presented by SB Nation and Bleeding Green Nation.
You are flying high on the Kist and Solak Show. This is episode 210, brought to you by the Five Folk at SB Nation and Bleeding Green Nation. I am your host, Michael Kist. Follow me on Twitter at MichaelKistNFL. That's K-I-S-T, as always. Joined by the best doggone co-host in the game, Mr. 10-Year Streak Without a Bad Day. He is Benjamin Solak. Follow him on Twitter at Benjamin Solak. That's S-O-L-A-K, Ben. Happy Saturday, man. How you doing?
Oh, man. Everything is delicious, Mike. Thanks for asking.
Yeah.
The Eagles are in disarray. I'm kind of enjoying it.
Everything is chaos. And I'm already getting tired of the arguments on the Twitter timelines regarding who deserves credit for what was unlucky, what was luck, and who was responsible for the Super Bowl. Because I feel like nobody is getting any kind of credit for 2017 anymore. It's all revisionist history. But here we are trying to make sense of it all. And I mean, we might as well kind of dive into that conversation right now. We are going to be doing the Seahawks preview, making our predictions, so on and so forth, talking about the reconfigurations again along the Eagles offensive line. But first, there are reports out there, and there's been chatter around this September talking about Doug Peterson and how he would feel if he were fired. Now this comes from Paul Dumowich, who was talking with Joe Banner, and here's the quote from the article. Banner says, if he is fired, and I doubt he is, reaching the point where he's kind of had it, he's probably just frustrated with internal dynamics and maybe some things that he had to do that didn't work out, or things that he would like to do and isn't being allowed to do. That's when it becomes a little hopeless as a head coach, and it makes you feel like you can't overcome it, end quote. So, I mean, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what's going on in the power structure with the Eagles, and I'm not saying misunderstanding because it's being presented wrong. I'm saying misunderstanding because we have no idea what decisions he's making. For instance, the Jalen Hurts pick, who is that on? Also, I think we know some of the decisions surrounding Doug, Mike Rowe, saying that Mike Rowe would stay. And then he's fired, saying that Jason Peters, right, and we'll get into this later, would be the left tackle a couple of days ago. And then next thing you know, he's being kicked into right guard, which is a total reversal of how we thought that was going to go. Anyway, this is stemming back from a September report from Tony Pauline saying, quote, there are some rumblings from people inside the league who I spoke with earlier this week who feel that Doug Peterson may have reached his limit. Doug Peterson may be a little bit stressed out. Basically, it's not going to get any better for Doug Peterson, end quote. This whole picture is very muddy with Doug. Does he want to be there? Is he burnt out? Is it all Frank Reich's doing for 2017 and so on? Like, so many questions, so many debates. Get a little tired of it, to be honest with you. I have no idea what's in the man's heart, but we are going to wildly speculate about it, aren't we?
Yeah, here we go. Yeah. Okay. So, okay. This is all right. I think you first go back to like 2013, right? And it's Banner in Cleveland, and it's Lurie and Roseman in Philly, and they're going after Chip Kelly. You know, there's all the quotes that are like, oh, Roseman sucks. He's out of his depth. He's got no idea what he's doing. And then Jeffrey Lurie's like, those came from Cleveland. And it's like, whoa! And then Joe Banner was like, nah, that wasn't me. And there's that whole nonsense. And like, let's not, like, you know, Banner was in with Roseman and Lurie. He brought Roseman up. Roseman eventually replaced him, and Lurie fired him. So let's not act like, you know, Joe Banner has been like really like I think like an interesting and at times valuable resource in the media for Eagles media for the last couple of years. Let's not act like he's like coming into this from an objective lens. Let's start with that. Number one. Number two, Banner has said recently, October, that he doesn't think that they're going to make wholesale changes, right? Like, he doesn't think it's going to get like blown up. He also says he doesn't think Doug Peterson's going to get fired. Right. So if I'm doing math here, it's not going to be everybody gets fired. It's not going to be Peterson getting fired. To me, that indicates that if he thinks anybody's getting fired, it's Howie, right? Mm-hmm. And so
that's what I think it is,
right.
By the way.
And that's the thing is when you say, listen, you know, I want to make sure I get the quote right. He's probably just frustrated with internal dynamics. When you're talking about the head coach, internal dynamics, there's about two, maybe three people who are above the head coach.
Maybe
something he had to do that didn't work out, or things he would like to do that he isn't being allowed to do. That's not like, you know, I'm frustrated with my wide receiver coach. Like, you're in charge of your wide receiver coach, my dude. You know, this is, when you say frustrated with internal dynamics, that's Lurie, that's Roseman. And then, by extension, you know, we know that there's been the reports that, like, Wentz has more power in the building than Peterson does. There's been the reports that, like, you know, Jason Peters can do no wrong because he's best friends with Jeff Lurie. By extension, then, those players are quasi above Peterson. That's kind of the internal dynamics that you end up talking about. And so...
Yeah, also, like, how the draft works, who makes those decisions, which we don't know, but please continue. Yeah.
Right, I mean, there was the whole report that was like, oh, the scouting staff wanted Justin Jefferson and the coaching staff wanted Jalen Reagor. And it's like, so that report right there. Mm. Obviously, Eagles fans, like, really locked in on Justin Jefferson over the past draft cycle, and Jefferson's playing great in Minnesota. But that happens in every team with every pick at every position, every draft.
Explain why that is.
Right.
Because if you're anonymous scout and I'm coming to you and I'm saying, hey, this looked pretty messed up. Whose fault is it? Are you going to say you?
Right. Number one, are you going to say you? No. Number two, even if it's like clear that it was your guy, you just blame the coaching staff. But I've said this before. There is a need. There is an inherent tension. There must be struggle between your front office and your coaching staff, because your front office should be oriented on building a team that for the future will be successful. And your coaching staff should be oriented on building a team that right now will be successful. There is no coaching staff in the league that wants rookies, right? Occasionally there is when you get a coaching staff on board with a tank. But that's the whole idea, is that we really can't be good now, so we're going to try really hard to be good later. And then the flip side of that coin, arguably, is the last few seasons of the Eagles. I don't know what the opposite of a tank would be, but you could argue that Roseman neglected his responsibility as the general manager to really try to build out for the future and be safe in the future by making a lot of cap-related moves, a lot of free agent signings, such as to maximize a current winning window, right? And that's what Roseman has been preaching. That's the gospel he's been sharing for the last 2-3 years. It's been, we rookie quarterback, we maximize our window, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Big piece about it, Bleeding Green that I wrote about last year, whatever. So, you want, like, in every draft room, in every franchise this year, there was a coach who was like, there was a coach who said, I do not want, I want Jeffrey Okuda. I don't want CJ Henderson. Okuda's ready to play now. And then there was a general manager who said, I think CJ Henderson's a better prospect long term and I want him. And that's you have to have that fight. You had like, there's yes. obviously you agree with that, but the two entities should be pulling in different ways. So there should be some difficulty there. If the head coach feels neutered, to the point at which he would not care if he were fired. He won a Super Bowl in a city in which he played football 3 years ago.
And if he
would not care, that's where you know that somewhere your tension has failed you. Somewhere somebody is making decisions that they shouldn't be making. You have an imbalance. And when you look at the last 8 years of Philadelphia football, 10 years of Philadelphia football under Jeff Lurie, you had Andy Reid, who they could not win a championship with. He leaves, is hired by Kansas City. He's won a championship there. Mike, I'm here to tell you, he's probably going to win another one or two. They got a pretty good quarterback there in Kansas City. You bring in Chip, it goes horribly. You have a massive power struggle through 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016. You resolve that by firing Chip, by reinstating Rosen, by bringing in Peterson. You're successful again for a year, not unlike you were the first year of Chip. And then guess where you are, Mike? 3 years later, power struggle, baby. So you at some point, buck stops up top. And you ownership. Your last three head coaching tenures have ended with really, really bad crashes and burns. And
they've been really aggressive at different points in all three of those after experiencing some success, and they have the bottom has fallen out horrifically on all three.
I do believe that aggressive play, bottoms out, make a change, is preferable to being like the Jaguars, who are like, maybe Doug Marone's going to be good this year, guys. Like, that's just agonizing, right? When your team is just like accepting of mediocrity to decency for like 5 years. Like, that to me, like, I would much rather this. At least it's interesting to talk about. But you look at Lurie, and then you also have to look at Roseman in that as well, because Roseman's been a significant executive in that entire 10-year split as well. And so I think this report increased the intensity of something we knew to be true, which is like the power balance in Philadelphia is not good. You know, obviously when you have Peterson saying, yeah, we're not going to fire Groh, and then they fire Groh, and he's like, yeah, Peterson's our left tackle, and then he's not. Like, it's very clear that he's not the one making these decisions, and that's bad. But to say that, like, Peterson's half hoping, I didn't say half hoping, but Peterson's like half hoping he gets fired so he can get the heck out of here, really indicates to you the significance, the desperateness of this issue.
And then you also, who had the report that like Doug Peterson doesn't know who's going to play like during the week, like Howie Roseman and company make that decision on Saturday and Doug's not a part of that decision. And then Doug is told who will play. So he's not even involved in that decision making.
That's why the balance, it's like your front office is trying to win games later and your head coach trying to win games now. Your coaching staff trying to win games now. If you're not letting your coach choose who he plays on Sunday, he doesn't have a hand in trying to figure out who plays now or how to win games now, you know?
Yeah, so I can see why Doug would be a little disenfranchised with what's going on. So I do think, like, someone asked me, like, what's your best guess? You know, stay or go? And BGN Radio 157 did this, but my answer at the time was Roseman goes, Peterson stays, Wentz stays. Are you the same there?
Yes.
Best, you think best odds like 51% to 49%, or like, I mean, where are you with Doug?
I think so, but I also think that, like, you know, I think there's a good chance that, like, from this report, like, there's a chance Peterson's just like, I'm out. Like, it's not even like, I'm not like, you're not making this decision here, right? And I get
that's true.
And if he does like a it's Roseman or it's me thing to Lurie, Roseman survived a couple of those already, brother. Like, even when Chip Kelly did that, Roseman still stayed, you know? Like, it's,
you think there's, do you think there would be certain caveats if they did kind of want to get rid of Doug? Okay, number one, you have to hire an OC and you may have to give up play calling. Do you think Doug will be like, you want me to give up play calling? All right, man, see ya.
Right, and maybe, you know, it's tricky. And it's funny because the other side of this coin is Eric Eager from PFF has been talking today about, like, you know, for WAR, for war for PFF, which is wins above replacement, which just kind of just encapsulates how well a particular player is performing.
Right.
Wentz has one of the highest, the biggest spreads in terms of his ceiling and his floor in this metric for them. And, you know, he's just talking about, like, just within the scope of this metric and the scope of previous performances in this metric, what is the chance that Wentz bounces back to a significant level? And it's not great. You know, it shouldn't shock anybody that, like, Wentz playing this badly. You know, I've said a lot in the previous podcast, and I still believe, you know, I think Wentz is a better quarterback than this. I think if you took Wentz and just put him in a different team right now, he'd be playing better. You know, so I think that he gets better, but, like, the chances aren't great that he gets back to, like, a really high level.
Right.
So the question Eric's asking is, like, this coaching staff has been successful without Wentz.
Yes.
Like, the way they performed with Nick Foles over a couple of years. This was believed to be a good coaching staff. How long are you comfortable saddling this coaching staff with Wentz? Are you willing to lose Doug for the sake of Wentz? It's like, well, they're kind of financially tied to Wentz. But anyway, so there's a whole opposite side. You can come at this conversation from the other direction and talk about what the quarterback means. But so, yeah, I don't think we have a good vibe. I think that a lot of, you know, the next six games will matter. Like, you know, we still have to entertain the reality in which Jalen Hurts plays the last two games, beats Dallas, beats Washington, and the Eagles make the playoffs with a backup quarterback for the third year in 4 years. And if this happens, I mean, just like, what do we do with that? You know, so it's there's still, I think, a lot that's got to get sussed out. So I refuse to commit yet, and you can make fun of me for that if you want to.
Yeah, long answer, some nuance there, and no answer. There you go, Ben.
Listen, it's all about the discussion.
That's right. No, I agree. I mean, it is complicated, and it sucks that we can't really have that. Well, should we keep Doug instead of Wentz? But we can't, because they've got that contract with Wentz. It's just not possible. And you talked about the success without Wentz. It's not just the Super Bowl run, guys. 2018, they had a 14% chance to make the playoffs. And yeah, there was probably some issues with the coaching there too, but there's issues with the quarterback as well. Nick Foles comes in And next thing you know, you win. What did they win? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 out of the last 6. They beat 2 playoff teams in the Los Angeles Rams and the Houston Texans, along with taking care of their divisional games. Mm-hmm. They beat the Bears in a wild card game. This was, by the way, the 31st most banged up team per adjusted games lost of Football Outsiders in the NFL. The most banged up team that I could find in the history of them doing that to win a playoff game. What does that come down to?
Right.
Who do you give credit for that?
That's the tricky thing. Is like, it was so much easier to be giving credit to this team for X, Y, and Z when they were functional. Now they're not functional. You kind of are looking back and you're just like, did we know who was good?
Frank Reich wasn't on the staff then, right? He didn't call the plays in 2017, but everybody wants to give him credit because it always feels like everybody else in the organization exists to take blame off of the quarterback. At least from the fan base's perspective, right? Because they're so invested in his success. And I get it. You want the guy to be good, but like at some point you got to step back and look and say, hey, there was a lot of other things going on, man, without him.
Yeah. It's funny. I feel like your mentions are you know, diametric to mine, where my mentions are just like everything I post. It's like, why are you not talking about what Wentz did here? And it's like, because I'm just like, firstly, I'm exhausted. And secondly, I'm interested in the other players as well.
All right. So let's get into this offensive line stuff before we get into the preview here, since we went a little bit long on that. So the news, obviously, that we alluded to already, the Eagles, since we last spoke, Jason Peters is kicking into right guard. Jordan Mailata will get the start at left tackle. Lane Johnson is shutting it down for the season due to his ankle injury, says it's essentially collapsed on him. I detailed that part of it on the most recent quick jam. We know that he's been dealing with that for a while. But with him out and Jack Driscoll nursing a knee injury, that means that Matt Pryor likely gets the start at right tackle. I think Jeff McClain just tweeted out that in fact, is the lineup. So let's go from left to right. Jordan Mailata, Isaac Seumalo, Jason Kelsey, who was also dealing with an elbow injury from the last game, then Jason Peters and Matt Pryor. That might be your combination. That's the most updated info I have as we record this. Ben, that's a lot to process, but we were both on the side of starting Mailata at left tackle a few weeks ago. We said, okay, one game is fine past that. Now we're getting upset. It's been past that, but now they try to correct that. And then we also get to see what life is like without Lane Johnson, who is only giving up a pressure on 2.5% of his snaps this year, despite being incredibly banged up. The best rate by far of any of the Eagles tackles. So those two bookends, it's a real question mark. It will be the 10th different combination for the Eagles on their offensive line through 11 games this season.
Hell,
Ben, how does that impact this game? What do you think it means long term? What is it looking like to you? Do you think this is better than the previous configuration? Well, obviously Lane's out, so I can't even say that. But let's start with the left side of the line.
Yes,
this is better, right?
Yes, right. So Mailata, if he is as bad as Peters was, A, it would just be like more okay because he's his 12th round pick from 2018, you know, rugby, you know, total neophyte to the position. It would also be a surprise relative to how he played early in the season, which was objectively better than how Peters plays, which, you know, is kind of why we were all hoping that Jordan Mailata would start at left tackle over Jason Peters earlier this year.
And let's qualify that. We thought he was playing better. I thought it was by a small margin. Did you think it was by a small margin?
Yeah, or
you thought
it was bigger? So Peters' worst game was last week. So yes, it makes sense that if there was a bar that Pryor had previously been over, or not Pryor, excuse me, Peters had previously been over that he then went behind, that he then went under, that had happened in this past game. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's also worth noting, like, Mailata, you know, isn't great. He's not, there's not, like, you know, he gets beat up by really good players. Like, the Pittsburgh game was terrible. But, like, it's more forgivable. It's actively okay.
Right.
With that said, yes, I think Mailata is giving you a little bit more. And at the very least, if like you're just more willing to help Mailata than you're willing to help Peters, then that's like good, because both need help. And so if you're just more doing it, then that's great. Now, what matters for the left side of the line is your long term, right? Number one, if Jordan Mailata is at all functional as a starting left tackle, if Mailata plays well enough that you can believe that he and Dillard going into next season will at least give you one starting caliber tackle, that's huge for your top 10 draft pick.
Yeah,
because now your money, your book, because you don't need to go and acquire a left tackle, get a big level, you get a veteran guy, whatever, you get a middle round draft pick, whatever. You don't need that top 10 pick to be spent on a left tackle, and it's also not a good draft to be in that situation anyway. So that long term is where that matters on the left hand side of the line. Isaac Seumalo hopefully being healthy, being back, playing as average as Isaac Seumalo usually plays is fine. The big question for him is if he's going to be the center when Kelsey retires, which I imagine Kelsey's going to do after this year. But they're not going to get that answer at left guard. You know, they need to know more about him, firstly, snapping consistently, and then secondly, how he does protections-wise and decisions-wise. But I think if you're able to prove over the next 6 weeks that Mailata is your left tackle, is even potentially your left tackle of the future, it just gives you more flexibility with what you do with your resources come this offseason. Right side, listen, but like, Jordan Mailata, left side of the line, playing well, whatever. Matt Pryor as the right tackle is going to be apocalyptically bad, Mike.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be bad.
Mike, I thought he could survive at guard, and he hasn't. At tackle, he does not know how to move backwards. Yeah. Doesn't has no idea that he has the muscles. Doesn't
what do
even
you do
know
for that. Exactly,
right? He just does, he is so aggressive. So now, if they run play action out the wazoo, maybe because he's fine coming off the line. But the problem is their play action stuff A has been terrible, and B they don't really have a ton of good shotgun play action stuff. A lot of the play action stuff they try to do is under center, and it's atrocious. And so I don't like that. Your best way to protect him is play action. Chipping won't help him because he sets so short that even if you chip a guy, they're just going to be able to get inside of him, or they're going to be able to go through him. He just does not know how to gain depth. He does not know how to like defend reactively. And so him at right tackle is I don't know if I'm more concerned about that or back when Suo Peta was put at left guard. Like this might be the worst single offensive lineman out of position yet this year. And what's really annoying is Jack Driscoll was not half bad at right tackle. He really wasn't. Is he as big of a tackle as the Eagles want him to be? Absolutely not. Is he still limited and potentially banged up? Yes. But if he's healthy, you got to play him at right tackle over Pryor. Pryor is not able to move on the outside.
But that's the problem. You know, long term, I think Driscoll does come in for him. But right now he's dealing with a knee and he has not participated and whatnot. And his status for Sunday is up in the air. And look, this Seattle defense is known as a bit of a cupcake. A part of that is due to the pressure that they haven't been getting this year. I think they're bottom five in pressure percentage over the past three, I would say, with the exception of the Rams game. I think that's gotten better. Rams, I mean, they got no pressure against Jared Goff, as everybody can see. But, you know, the 3 weeks ago against the Buffalo Bills, they pressured Josh Allen 42% of the time. Last game, Kyler Murray, right? One of the most pressured quarterbacks of the week against them at 51%. The Carlos Dunlap signing obviously paying dividends right away for them as he comes up with the game-winning sack or the game-ending sack to end that one. Still, I'm not overly concerned in this area, and let's kind of get into our over-unders here. Mm-hmm. The line is that the Seahawks are 5.5-point favorites. The over-under is 49. So Vegas is saying roughly that it's going to be like 27-22 Seahawks. Philadelphia is averaging exactly 22 points per game, 19 over the last three games, while Seattle is leaking 28.7 points per game, with that number trending slightly up lately. We might as well just go rapid fire through our offense versus defense takes here as we preview this one. I think we know what it is. I mean, the Seahawks defense having issues with pressure, can't really cover, but this is the Eagles offense that hasn't been able to get anything going or scheme up anything or execute anything. There's always something going wrong on any given play or some sort of backbreaking penalty, early down stuff that puts them at disadvantageous third downs. But again, I mean, this is the Seahawks. Everybody kind of plays them weirdly because they're a weird team. What do you think? Over under on the 22 points for the Eagles offense?
I once again feel under, and I once again believe that the Eagles will go over on a meaningless end of game drive in a two possession game. You know what I mean? Like that's what I'm worried about there. So the Seahawks defense, right? And people have been talking for a while about the Seahawks injuries in the secondary and the weaknesses in the secondary. They've actually not fully returned to health, but they're looking better. They've got Trey Flowers, who was a starter last year, replacing Shaq Griffin. Mm-hmm. DJ Reed was playing their opposite corner coming into the Arizona game, and that was terrifying for Seattle fans. But they ended up actually playing pretty well, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, Shaq Griffin wasn't necessarily playing the best football of his life coming into that game, and Quentin Dunbar like was fine, but they kind of went nuts about how well he was going to do after PFF. You know, like he ran out really well for PFF last year, and I don't really think that he's necessarily like panned out the way they expected to pan out. So he's on Dunbar's on IR. Shaq Griffin's still questionable for this game. You're potentially getting Trey Flowers and DJ Reed again. If that's the case, what is interesting for the Eagles passing game is that the where you don't want to throw against Seattle is over the middle behind those linebackers because they're so good in coverage, and they've got, you know, Jamal Adams, Quandre Diggs. They got a good duo of safeties there. The Eagles haven't tried to throw over the middle in 5 games. They don't want to let Wentz do it anymore. So many of his interceptions came between the numbers trying to throw layered balls that they just stopped. There's exclusively a half field breaking outside sort of an offense. So you're going to be able to get your isolation looks against those wide receivers, against the against those corners with your wide receivers. You're going to get Rager versus Flowers, which is a huge speed matchup. You're going to get Fulgham versus Reed, which is a huge size disadvantage. Yeah, on paper, sure. But why are you going to believe in this passing game? With Pryor playing, and they have Carlos Dunlap now installed. So he's been their pass rusher. They have Rasheem Green now back from injury. I don't think Daryl Taylor is going to be back for this game. But their pass rush has gotten better. They've gotten some relief over the last couple of games. I think that they're going to be able to generate a ton of pressure, not only on their blitz packages, which the Eagles haven't been able to pick up this year, but also just with a 4-man rush. And I don't trust the Eagles passing game to take advantage of favorable matchups on the outside. So I'll still take under. To me, that's, you know, it's like a 20-19 point game for Philadelphia. They're going to have dumb turnovers. They're going to get inside the Seattle 40 and then fail on a fourth down conversion or have penalties and fall out of field goal range. They're going to move the ball once again, and they're not going to get points out of it once again because there's no reason to believe that they can do otherwise at this point.
And you mentioned the linebackers for Seattle. I agree with you when it comes to that intermediate stuff. Now the Eagles have shied away from it, and I hope they shy away from it in this game because, what is it, Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright, and Jordan Brooks?
Yep.
Those are three really solid coverage guys.
And like Jamal Adams, who like technically isn't a linebacker, but also like he hangs around that area of the field and obviously is basically an edge rusher. It doesn't matter. right.
But if you target him in that area, it's going to be a lot better for him than if he ends up, you know, working versus empty, trying to cover a post, essentially.
Right. And when you look at how the Eagles, like last week, the Eagles just like, firstly, they've fully nuked John Hightower. Hightower has 4 snaps over the last 2 weeks. They're done with this, right? With Rager back, they don't care. Alshon went from 18 snaps to 5 snaps. They had only 3 receivers take more than 6 snaps last week. Ward, Fulgham, Rager. That's your 3. They are never going to get lighter than 11 personnel, right? So what you're looking at here in terms of the way you want to go about this is you want to leave tight ends in, leave running backs in, put Ward on one or put Rager on one side, put Fulgham on the other side, and have Wentz throw matchups. Like if you have Fulgham against Reed, 12 yards, turn around, throw him the ball. Mm-hmm. And like you it's wild to say this, but you need your 2019 sixth round pick journeyman to just be better than the other guy's guy. That's where you are offensively right now. And if they're gonna give you man, take it. And just throw first read. And that it has to be that simple right now. And once you can execute that, let's have a conversation about other things, right? Like with your zone, when you get zone, you run space and you run all the stuff you usually run. Carson's kind of been decent against zone recently, whatever. That is as far as you can get it. I'm going to do everything I can to get an outside receiver against one of these corners. And if I get Rager against Flowers and if I get Fulham against Reed, that's where I'm going with the football. Fundamentally execute that. And you should be able to generate a passing game.
I agree.
You have enough talent here.
I agree.
But, you know, I think that the pass rush is going to be a problem. I think that the Seahawks move their guys around enough in the secondary. They do enough split field stuff that Wentz is going to get bamboozled. It's just there's no reason to have faith in even this simple of an idea.
I agree. I'm going to go under on that one. And by the way, Doug Peterson in his presser today confirming that Matt Pryor will be at right tackle and that Zach Ertz is not expected to play as we expected. So when we come back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Smooth transitions out. Yep. This is good podcasting over here.
So when I might just leave that in. So when we come back here on the Kissed and Solak show, we'll get into the Eagles defense against the Seattle offense and we'll give our final predictions. That's coming up next. Right here on the Kissed and Solak show. Saved it. Perfectly professional.
Oh, dude, yeah, absolutely. We're good at this.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
And we are back here on the Kissed and Solek Show, episode 210, brought to you by SB Nation, Bleeding Green Nation, Michael Kissed here with Benjamin Solek. Ben, all right, let's flip sides of the ball. Let's make our final predictions and let's get the heck out of here. I think for Seattle's offense, the thing to note is, hey, it's Russell Wilson and he's really good at football. Mm-hmm. Why hasn't Russell Wilson made the Eagles pay more, at least looking at like last year and whatnot? Like, I don't know, man. I can't explain it to you. I can't explain the Seahawks to you. But what I can explain to you is that, man, you look up these matchups that they can create. DK Metcalf on the year, 48 receptions, 862 yards, 9 touchdowns. Tyler Lockett, 67 receptions, 748 yards, 8 touchdowns. I'm starting to believe that he's no longer underrated. I think people are starting to recognize that Lockett is a really doggone good football player. Metcalf, for his part, I mean, he has been taken away in a game or two this year, but you got to throw a lot of attention at that dude. And one ball is all he needs to take it to the house. And he's going to have Eagles fans in their feelings this one. What do you think of this matchup?
I don't know. So Metcalf has played two games against the Eagles, right? The first game was regular season. That was 17-9, totally garbage game. Nobody cared. Playoff game, also in the link, also 17-9. He had 9 targets, 7 catches, 160 yards, and a touchdown. So Do we think 3 catches, 35 yards? Or 7 catches, 160 yards, and a touchdown? Which one do we think we're getting? Which Metcalf we think we're getting this week?
Now, remember what happened in that first game. Because I think Russell Wilson missed him on a big one. And then DK dropped another one, if I'm not mistaken.
I remember the drop.
Yeah, where he burned Mills, and Mills did the celebration and the finger wag and all that stuff. And everybody partied. So, because of that, he had those big play opportunities. They just missed on a couple of them. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead and say that this is over 100 yards for DK Metcalf. Have you seen the prop bets on that yet? Is something that we can bet on? Because I'm going over.
They've just opened, and if memory serves, he opened at 74.
I was going to say
a lot this morning, but yeah,
that probably makes sense. I was going to say like around 80. I'm comfortably on 70. I'm smashing the over on that.
Right. Here, do you want to know the funniest? So I was looking at stats to understand the Seahawks deep passing game. Wild stat to me. Russell Wilson has attempted a deep pass on 12.7% of his passing attempts this year. This is for PFF. Right. It's only 14th in the league, tied for 14th with Gardner Minshew, of all people. 12.7%. Wentz is fifth. 14.1%. Yep. But behind Joe Flacco, Kirk Cousins, Drew Locke, whole list of bad quarterbacks. Wentz has completed 41.5% of his deep passes. Mm-hmm. Russell Wilson, 43.5%. It's not that big of a difference.
Yeah.
Now, are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Russell Wilson has thrown 11 touchdowns and 3 interceptions. Carson Wentz has thrown 4 touchdowns and 5 interceptions. What?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the passer rating is nearly half. Like, Wentz is 64 and Russ is like 105 or something like that, right? It's massive difference in how well they performed. But Wentz is throwing the ball down the field more, and they're still completing. They're completing roughly the same number of passes. It's just... Wentz is completing passes to defenses? I don't know.
Right. Now, and this is, I think this is that adjusted completion percentage? Or are
yes,
you talking
that's
about
adjusted.
Completion?
Okay. Right, with drops. Okay. So you got, you know, the average John Hightower football game, yes.
And like, for Wentz, I mean, honestly, like, he has always been around like 44%. This is like only a slight dip. I think it's the rest of the accuracy in the intermediate right. to short
and it's
areas
also,
where he's struggling.
Wentz is, I would argue, and I've no basis for filming this. I would argue because the deep passes are 20 plus air yards. I would argue yeah. that Wentz's average deep pass before this season was like 30 air yards, and this year it's like 58. Right? Yeah. It's like they're just like, you know what I mean? Like
I agree.
They're like more like, oh, like deep posts and like, you know, like Lambert and like this and working deep digs and da da da. Now this year it's like Jalen Rager's fast, John Hightower's fast. Yeet. Now, the Eagles' defense this year has been one of the best against in terms of limiting explosive passing plays. The Eagles are actually 3rd in the league right now in terms of their explosive passing plays given up, just behind Baltimore and the Los Angeles Rams, which are two really good defenses overall. The Eagles obviously are right around an average defense by DVOA, but
well, look at their corners and look ahead at the Eagles' corners
and their coordinators and the pass rushers they're dealing with, so on and so forth, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So you're talking about a defense that's in the passing game has been really, really good at limiting explosive plays. To what degree is this a fragment of how easily they give up underneath patterns, linebackers and safeties and the way that they align? You know, that's up for debate. But you're going to see an orientation on taking away the deep ball from Philadelphia. And they've been successful at doing this. They have a good man coverage down the field, good safety play from Rodney McLeod, whatever it is. With that said, the push for Seattle recently, and, you know, Seattle had the let Russ cook theory going on. You know, they were really explosive early in the year. They've since moved away from that a little bit because defenses are far more willing to take it away. And Russ, at times, is very risk-prone, just chucking the ball down the field, inviting sacks, inviting interceptions by being too aggressive. Over the last 2-3 weeks, they've done a really good job at making Russ take shorter patterns and take quicker passes and be more willing to be a balanced offense in terms of their volatility, in terms of the passing routes that they look for, the route distribution they're attacking, taking what the defense gives you is the moral of this story. And so while Seattle is known for being an explosive passing offense, they've actually been below average in that measure over the last 3 weeks. They're going to stay below average against the Eagles, and they're going to continue to be able to nickel and dime. So while, yes, there's the terror of Russell Wilson and heavy protection and DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett and all those vertical balls, if the Eagles sit in single high, man coverage, go heavy boxes against Chris Carson, who's back this week, then, yeah, you're going to see your occasional deep shot. But I would not be surprised if this is a still pass heavy script from Seattle, but they're willing to take short intermediate stuff. They've been very willing to target Greg Olsen this year, even though Olsen's been bad against the Eagles linebackers. I would imagine they continue to target Greg Olsen. Olsen's injured now, so it's Will Dissly, but they've been willing to target their tight ends. I think they're going to continue to do so. I don't anticipate the Eagles being able to stop this passing game. Wilson's got far too much talent. And whenever we talk about the Eagles defense, we talk about how much can the pass rush affect this game. Seattle's passing pass blocking isn't that good. That quarterback's really good at extending. So unless you're able to regularly land on Wilson with sacks and not pressures, you're not going to be able to impact his game as much as you want. He's one of the best under pressure. So it's difficult to imagine the Eagles having much success against the pass. And then against the run, as I said, with Chris Carson back, we saw this team be successful with Carlos Hyde last week against the Cardinals. They have their talent now at running back. They have a good run blocking line. I don't think it's going to be a big part of their game script. I don't think they're going to be any more successful than Cleveland was or the Giants were, so on and so forth. You don't anticipate, like, when it comes to Wilson and this receiving core, stopping the run is a nice consolation prize, but what's the point, you know?
Are you shadowing DK Metcalf with Darius Slay just to make sure that you don't get DK Metcalf against Davante Maddox?
I mean, sure. I'm here to tell you, Maddox can't cover Lockett either. It might look prettier, might look nicer pre-snap, but it still ain't going to look good by the end of the snap, brother. So, yeah, I think they do. If they don't do it in the first half, I'd imagine they're forced into doing it by the second half.
Right.
With that said,
I don't think it matters.
Right, exactly. The way, like, you know, David Moore is good, right?
Yeah,
like, this
right.
is like, there's, I just don't see how you, I understand how you mirror with Slay and follow Metcalf, but then you're going to sit down at halftime and ask yourself, should we take him off Metcalf and put him on Lockett? Because this is the fate you've wrought for yourself by the talent in your cornerback room. If there is a path for the Eagles, it is Slay on Metcalf, eliminating Metcalf. They would need Slay to really play to his billing, and they would need Wilson to be unwilling to get off that matchup, which is possible because Wilson's been obstinate before. But they've been smarter with their target distribution. They, you know, there was a lot of run for how Wilson didn't target Metcalf in that loss to the Rams. But the reality was Rams put Ramsey on him. Metcalf was open, but there's no reason to be challenging that when instead you can be challenging other matchups, which Wilson did with some success. He just made a couple of really boneheaded plays in really high leverage situations, which is uncharacteristic for Wilson. But like I said, at times he gets stubborn, and hopefully that's the Wilson that you get on Monday night.
Yeah, Darius Williams is also has some fantastic ball skills.
Yeah, man. Big Darius Williams fan.
Yeah, big time. Man, got a ton of interceptions to start his career. Anyway, all right. So let's get into the prediction here, and I have one more question for you about this game. Based on what the Buffalo Bills did to the Seattle Seahawks and some cries that we might hear from the fan base during the game. But again, 5.5 points favorites for the Seahawks. We both said under for 22 points for the Eagles offense. Are you over or under the 27 points for the Seahawks on offense?
I'm over.
I'm over.
No faith, no reason for faith, right? Yep. Like, you know, and like the defense has shown when they play really good teams, if the offense is scoring points, the defense won't stop anybody. So even if you're getting a good game from the offense, I don't think you're going to get a good game from the defense. The hope is come out and split field, come out with Slay on Metcalf, encourage the run, take it away with seven. It's very unlikely the Eagles do this, but that would be the hope. That'd be how you want to beat Seattle. That's kind of what the Rams put out there that I think will be successful against them in the playoffs by smarter teams who are willing to change their matchups relative to their opponent. Not us.
Yeah, so I'm with you. I'm thinking it's like 31 to like 14 or 17, something
like
that.
I'm like 34-19, but it'll actually end up being 34-27 because the Eagles will score an 8-point touchdown at the end of the game and it won't matter, so on and so forth.
Right. Seattle scored over 30 points 7 times this season. I have no reason to believe they won't do it again.
There's a good chance that like the Eagles actually do hold them to 20 and it's a great performance by the defense and the offense wastes it. Or the Eagles offense comes out, runs the football down Seattle's throat, scores 27 points, Miles Sanders 150 yards, and the defense wastes it. Like, we're projecting like a pretty significant blowout. I'm sure one unit will overperform our expectations, but both won't.
Now here's the question I have for you. That's a perfect segue, because the Seattle rush defense in terms of efficiency is much better, much more stout than the Seattle pass defense. Buffalo saw this and came out with a game script that wildly leaned to the passing game. I think at one point they had 28 dropbacks versus like 5 runs. They didn't have between the running backs, they had 11 carries for the running backs, right? Isaiah McKenzie had a carry thrown in there. Josh Allen had 7 carries. Some of that was scrambles. Josh Allen threw the ball 38 times in that game, often and early. They didn't want to test the run game because Buffalo is struggling in the run game a little bit. They wanted to throw the ball around, and they were able to against Seattle, and they were able to build the lead doing that. If Philadelphia comes out to this game and has that game plan, you know we're going to hear the cry, oh, Doug abandoned the run game again, but is that a sound strategy in this game, knowing that you're probably going to have to be in a boat race?
My issue is yes, but Buffalo was also able to go 4 wide. Philly
Correct.
Can't do it.
True.
They won't. One of the things that, like, when I brought up the fact that the Eagles basically played exclusively 3 receivers and they won't go lighter than 11 personnel was, you might look at this Seattle secondary and say, okay, Ryan Neal is injured, Delano Hill is injured, Shaq Griffin's out, Quentin Dunbar is out. Let's spread them and shred them. Philly can't! They don't got the horses! And I mean, how many times have we talked about empty sets and how good they've been for, like, they've been good for Philadelphia because Philadelphia's just been average in empty sets this year.
You know what's crazy is everybody is asking for play action boot rollouts when the Eagles stink at them. Nobody is asking for empty when the Eagles are fantastic
at
it.
And why do the Eagles stink at play action boot rollouts? This is totally not our podcast and we are so long right now. It doesn't matter. Why are they bad at play action boot rollouts? It's not because play action boot rollouts in and of themselves are bad. Moving Wentz off the spot works. Wentz is a better passer when he's on the move. It helps protection. Absolutely. They don't work because Wentz is not good right now. Like, when you go and you watch the cutups, it's because Wentz is making bad decisions and bad throws. Also, sometimes the designs suck, but sometimes they're good. So, it mostly, to me, that's on Wentz just making bad decisions on the hoof. When you talk about empty, empty more than any other formation, more than play action, more than no huddle, more than any fabrication that besides Sean McVay in your ear for 20 seconds gives the quarterback a pre-snap advantage. Because it is so hard as a defense to look like you're doing A against empty and actually be doing B. It's so you can't rotate a safety. There's too much space to cover. You can't be moving guys around post-snap. Like, obviously, you take away the threat of the play action, so the linebackers are pretty immediately in their drop, and that's going to take away some of your short underneath stuff. But if you're just throwing against leverage to the outside, which is all the Eagles do in the passing game anyway, empty can be so beneficial for you. I've stopped even thinking the Eagles might do it because they clearly don't have the personnel. They want to be a play-action team. They want to have multiple tight ends out on the field. And on top of everything, they don't... There's been no development this year on anything that's been good for them. Like, stuff that has worked for them, right? Like, Fulgham played well, and now they're not using Fulgham as much. Mailata played well, and then they benched Mailata. If something's working for the Eagles, they're not going to continue doing it because there's absolutely no direction right now in the coaching staff and in the front office. So, like, yeah, if I'm calling shots here, empty... We're going to run QB draw 15 times, okay? Yep. We're going to do it with Jalen Hurts 10 times. We're going to take Wentz off the field, put Hurts on the field, put him in empty, and then run QB draw RPOs. Stick draw RPO all the way down the goddamn field, Mike. But
yep. If you got numbers, run it. If not, throw right. This freaking stick. Yep.
Right, but I mean, when your second best receiver is Richard Rodgers, guess what? You can't play in empty since he's got his hand in the dirt.
Right. Great point to end it there, Ben. So, I mean, that's going to do it for this preview of the Seahawks and Eagles. We had some fun chats about some other topics as well. That's all just very sunny here in Philadelphia. Ben, any last words for the gentle listeners before we get on out of here?
Yeah, no. So thank you, as always, listening to the Kissed and Solak show here on BGN Radio. We got it out on Saturday because we have the Monday show, but also there's some frustration with internal matters right now. We're not sure, you know, some of us, some people inside, outside the organization think that Mike wouldn't be totally unhappy if he ends up getting fired. So we're just dealing with some stuff, and that's no problem. But no, we thank you as always for the Kissed and Solak show on BGN Radio. This was the Eagles Seahawks preview / discussion about how bad things are. The Eagles play in primetime again. Because somebody hates us. So Monday Night Football against the Seattle Seahawks with a whole pregame and postgame show breaking down the ineptitude that is Philadelphia. It should be fun. If you enjoyed the show and enjoy all the shows here on the feed, make sure you rate, review, and subscribe on whatever app you listen to your podcast. He's been Michael Kist on Twitter at Michael Kist NFL. It's KISD. I've been Benjamin Solak on Twitter at Benjamin Solak. That's Solak. We will talk to you probably Monday night. We're gonna have to stay up and do a postgame show. Frickin' heck me to heck. All right. Monday night if you're awake, Tuesday morning if you're not. That's when you hear us next.
I just, you know.
Depression.
Can you see why? Can you see why I'm sick of it? Yep. We all we got. We all we need. Fly, Eagles, fly.
It just gives you more flexibility with what you do with your resources come this offseason.
You caught me not listening again.
I usually do. Right side, listen, but like...
BGN!
Support for this show comes from Pendo. Pendo improves the apps your customers and employees rely on. Whether you're building applications for customers or managing applications for employees, Pendo can help deliver better experiences for your users so they can get more value from your software. Pendo also provides AI-powered product analytics that fuel in-app guides to deliver personalized guidance to customers directly inside your app. Visit pendo.io/podcast to learn more about how your team can use Pendo to start building better digital experiences. There, you can also check out Pendo's lineup of free certification courses, 12 hours of in-depth training for your product management teams on topics from AI to product analytics to product-led growth. That's pendo.io/podcast to learn more.